Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
My name is Kathy Langer. I'm the lead buyer for the Tattered Cover, and I want to thank you all for coming here tonight. This is going to be a really fun event. And I also want to thank you for supporting independent bookstores. We really appreciate your being here and all your support. And we are so pleased to have the opportunity to host such an intriguing event this evening. We can double our pleasure with two amazing Whitneys, accomplished Whitneys, as our guests. And before I introduce Whitney Otto, I just want Whitney Frick to stand up and say hello to the group, and then she'll have her time to talk later. So, our first Whitney, Whitney Otto, is the author of five novels. She first burst onto the literary scene about 20 years ago with her acclaimed debut novel, How to Make an American Quilt, followed by Now You See Her, The Passion Dream Book, and a collection of beauties at the height of their popularity. Her fifth, Eight Girls Taking Pictures, hit the shelves last week, and it's already on its way to the bestseller list. So, yay, Whitney! Eight Girls Taking Pictures focuses on eight women photographers whose lives and works span the 20th century. Six of the eight are based on real-life photographers. This remarkable novel opens up to the readers the lives of artists and the incredible creativity and work that is behind their art, not to mention the complications and compromises that come from being a woman artist. Though it is a novel, it's easy to forget that as one reads about the lives of the photographers. And the research alone must have been daunting, but I bet it was really fun, too. After reading Eight Girls Taking Pictures, I have a new respect for the challenges of women artists and will never look at photographs the way I used to, and it was a really fun read. Whitney Otto is the recipient of numerous literary grants and awards, and in addition to her novels, her work has appeared in anthologies, magazines, and newspapers, including the New York Times and the Los Angeles Times. She also has been in the New York Times crossword puzzle a few times and acknowledges the benefit of a crossword-friendly last name. And it may be an accident of birth, but she had to be noteworthy to be a good clue, and indeed she is. Join me in welcoming Whitney Otto.
Thank you, Kathy. Thank you, Tattered Cover. Thank all of you for coming. Thank you, Whitney. Okay, this is from the Mary Marks chapter, and Mary Marks is my Ruth Orkin character. And, okay, I'm just going to read about a page or so. 1959, New York City, Central Park West. Mary Marks was positioned at her dining room window, her Leica in hand, the camera trained on the sheep meadow of Central Park across the street from her apartment. At 15 stories up, Mary could shoot straight across, capturing the panorama of park and city skyline, or she could concentrate on the immediate view below, a section of street and sidewalk. On this day, it was the panorama of sky, structures, trees, and field. It was a spring afternoon with rain clouds gathering and bouncing, the light above reminding her of the English countryside. The fullness of the leafy trees contrasted with the clean, angular geometry of city buildings crowding behind, the expanse of the empty meadow spread out in front of the buildings and the greenery. Mary waited for the sun to shift ever so slightly before making three exposures. 2 months after Mary's return from Rome, she and David Rose quietly married, then spent their honeymoon in England, driving around the country, laughing more than she thought she could laugh, each in love with the other, and writing their first movie. It was a story of a nine-year-old boy who gets into a fight with some other boys on the street. As he miraculously pins one of them, the pinned boy blurts out that the first boy's father has a girlfriend. The boy is shocked and disbelieving, except he realizes that he doesn't really know his father's life outside of their home. The next day, Saturday, he follows his father all over New York City, jewelry store, flower shop, barber shop, ending up at the Plaza, beginning to believe that his father does indeed have a girlfriend, only to discover his father's rendezvousing with the boy's mother. Oh my God, we're already planning our own escape from our own children, joked David. In England, they had traveled on a budget, staying in guest houses, eating plowmen's lunches in pubs, sometimes driving through the night to save on lodging. Though the landscape was gorgeous and the long walks they took led them from one picturesque place to another, the mark of the war could still be found, not just in London but in Coventry, where they stayed one night, marked by new construction, the consequence of Luftwaffe bombings that had destroyed the historical city center. Mostly, Mary loved her walks with David and the way the sky could go from cloudy to sunny to golden to purple blue. It was the same quality of light and weather that she was looking at on this day in New York. Mary and David's movie about the 9-year-old boy garnered praise and awards at home and in Europe, inspiring young directors like Truffaut, influencing the new wave, showing how a smaller story over the course of 90 minutes could be transformed into a love letter to a city. Mary believed her life to be so ideal, it seemed one more Hollywood confection. As Mary gazed out her window, she saw four teenagers dressed up as if they were on a double date. She leaned out a little, her knee on the chair pushed up to the sill, framing the shot as the teens had stopped to awkwardly light cigarettes, so desperate for adulthood and sophistication. She had just focused when, "Mommy?" Their almost 4-year-old Teddy, who had been occupied with a set of colored blocks, stood next to her. She climbed onto the chair that Mary used to steady her camera, the high back acting as a guard. Mary could see that the four teens were no longer in the position she wanted, too far apart to be captured in a single frame and carrying too little tension individually, these kids who wanted to be anything but kids. Mary looked down at Teddy, who told her she was hungry. With one final glance out the window, she gently sent her camera down to next to her other camera, a Contax, and the rolls of film she always kept on the unused end of the dining room table, before lacing her fingers through Teddy's dark curls. She picked up her daughter's soft little hand and kissed her perfect fingers. Their first daughter was born in 1955 while David was in Venice for a showing of their film. The baby arrived a month early, otherwise David never would have gone. Unlike many fathers-to-be, he wanted to be with his wife. Though Mary was happy about the baby, she was worried that having one would change everything. That is, she couldn't quite picture how she would take care of the baby, the apartment, and still work. And for someone who had taken pictures herself since she was a child and had been working on her own since she was 17, Mary simply couldn't imagine not working, not taking pictures. Additionally, she and David had a second film lined up just before Mary discovered she was pregnant. David assured her that a baby was only a change in their lives and nothing more. But she hadn't counted on being as tired as she was or having a first child at 34 years old, nor could she have known how much she would love being with Teddy. She loved her company, her smell, her toothless smile, and her smooth little feet without feeling particularly maternal, or at least what she imagined maternal was meant to feel like. Elizabeth came along in 1957. Between Teddy and Elizabeth, David began his second movie, coming home or calling, depending on the length of the shoot, to check with Mary and keep her informed as if she were there, since they had developed the story together. Mary knew that he missed working with her. Their shared professional life added a dimension to their attachment. He wanted her there, but she couldn't be there because someone had to be here. And this was her paradox. She wanted to be in two places at once, to be two people at the same time. If she could split herself, one Mary would be happy spending all day with her toddling children with no thought about doing anything else. They would play with toys on the floor. She would enthusiastically read to them, nap when they napped, eat when they ate. Her other self would be making movies with David or possibly taking pictures on her own with no lingering regret about not having children or not being home with her children. She wondered if she felt this constant low-grade conflict because she had had a childless life, a profession prior to motherhood, only to discover too late that you cannot replace one life with another. And now she often lived in a place of suspension where she loved two things too much. Thank you.
Now I'll introduce our other Whitney. Whitney Frick grew up in Denver, attending Graylin and Colorado Academy. Following her career as a professional dancer, I'm not sure how many years that was, with the Colorado Ballet, she attended Northwestern University, graduating Phi Beta Kappa and magna cum laude. She is currently an editor at Scribner. Her first job in publishing was as assistant to Susan Moldau, the publisher of Scribner. This is worth noting because Susan Moldau is a brilliant publisher and must be an amazing mentor. Whitney was the inaugural winner of the Larry Ashmead Award, an annual prize granted to a promising young editor in the field of book publishing. And a huge perk of that award is attending the prestigious Yale Publishing course. Whitney has worked with critically lauded and best-selling authors such as Janine Roth, who's best known for her blockbuster hit Women, Food, and God, Joe Blair, whose book by the Iowa Sea I really loved, and Varley O'Connor, and that's just a few. She acquires upmarket women's fiction, voice-driven and inspirational memoir, and general lifestyle titles in the areas of health, relationship, psychology, and food. And one aside, one thing publishers are doing now in their catalogs is listing editors. Not all publishers do it, but Scribner does. When they're listing the books in the catalog copy and information, when I'm buying the new list, like right now I'm buying into summer of 2013, it's really great to see who the editors are, and I'm getting to know more and more of them, if not personally, at least by what they do. So it's really fun when I buy the Scribner catalog, which I just did a few weeks ago, seeing all of Whitney Frick's books, and I'm thinking, and knowing, and knowing that I like what she does, and that really makes a difference when you're buying. If you know the acquiring editor and what his or her taste is, it really informs the buyer's decision, and then that's what you end up seeing more of on our shelves. So I'm a little bit prejudiced, but it's my job to be prejudiced. One of Whitney's recent publications was 100 Foot Journey by Richard Moray, and that's been a tattered cover bestseller for over a year. It's been front and center in the new paperbacks if you shop at least at Colfax, and it's just a perennial great hand sell, and it's still there. So, and of course, we are here tonight to celebrate Eight Girls Taking Pictures by Whitney Otto, and to better understand the mysteries behind the publication of great books. And as a key player in the future of books and publishing, maybe Whitney Frick will look into her crystal ball and predict the future of this constantly changing industry. So, a big task. So my first question is for Whitney Otto. In your acknowledgments, you thank Whitney Frick, three times, in fact, and I'm quoting, "And thank you, thank you, thank you to my editor, the wonderful Whitney Frick, whose intelligence, insight, and impressively hard work have made this book better every step of the way." This may sound like hyperbole, but trust me, it's not. So my question is, actually, to you both, but first to Whitney Otto. What did she do to merit those thank yous? And maybe we should start with the wonderful serendipitous meeting of you two. If one of you wants to explain that.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for being here. I know almost all of you are friends of my parents and mine, and it really is so, so wonderful for you to be here, and thank you, Kathy, my most amazing champion, and this bookstore has been such a part of my life growing up and the life of my family and the schools that I went to, and it's really kind of a dream come true to, like, be here talking about my work. So Kathy mentioned that I started as an assistant to the publisher of Scribner, and this was sort of a Devil Wears Prada style job. My boss is the furthest thing from a devil. She is, as you said, an incredible mentor, but I, booked her cars and her lunches and did her email and all of that stuff, and she started writing emails to me, but Whitney Otto was the first contact in the W's in her BlackBerry. So she started accidentally sending emails directed to me to Whitney Otto. So Whitney Otto wrote back and said, I think you have someone working for you by this name. And I thought, I'll get in touch with her so that she knows she can just call me or forward me if anything else gets mistakenly sent her way. So this was 5 or 6 years ago. Yeah. And we were just kind of sporadically in touch, and Whitney Otto is an incredible novelist, but she also is, you know, there are people who just write really good emails. And she writes these, like, funny, witty stories, and we would sort of sporadically be in touch. So then, I think 3 years ago, Whitney's agent, who I had gotten to know, because one of the things you do as a young editor is try to get to know agents, emailed me and said, you know, Whitney's been working on this book, and she's kind of, like, at a standstill or just sort of not quite sure what she thinks about it, and it would help her to just talk to someone about it. Would you be willing to talk to her? And I said, yeah, of course, of course. So we got on the phone and started talking about photography and the women in the book, and I said, oh my God, the Ruth Orkin photo, American Girl in Italy, was the poster I took to college with me. Like, I know who you're talking about. But somehow in our conversation, I just assumed she was writing a novel. And I think at that point you were sort of maybe writing a biography.
Yeah, I was kind of...
Playing with it.
Yeah, I started out in 2003 thinking I was going to write this book that was going to be a little bit art history, a little bit biography, a little bit memoir, you know, just all these different things, you know, essentially unsellable. And then I put it down. and then I put it down before I even got a first draft done. And it was down for a few years, but I always wanted to take the same material and do a fictional treatment of it. It's just I sort of started with the nonfiction, but yes, by the time
we started talking, and you know, of course, I'm like pushing her to do what I think we could probably sell, like some hybrid of nonfiction and memoir, and it just wasn't. I couldn't see a way that we could like ever talk to people about that type of book. Yeah. But then when you got going on the novel, then it was just really fast, and so then Whitney's agent sent it to me on submission. And I read it and said, well, this is really great. This is, like, what I want to publish, exactly. So I bought it, and we worked on it a little bit. Not, you know, it didn't need... You feel like it was a lot of work. And so then it was released officially last Tuesday.
Yes.
So that's how we came to know one another. But then, so what work did we do?
Oh, my God. well, it's true. When I was talking to Whitney in that conversation, it really solidified that I wanted to go back into this book because I had it sitting there for like a few years, and I wanted to do it as fiction. I just wasn't as entranced with the idea of the nonfiction at that time. And then when I wrote it and Whitney read it, and, you know, it's funny because If you read the version that Whitney read, you'll see where the work came in. It's essentially the same, but there's so much work that Whitney did. I can't even tell you. I think that, you know, she read it, she went over it. You know, we made some changes together. She was just, it was so great to talk to her. I think her instincts were so good, and she's so right. And it's very hard. I mean, for a writer too, the book that you send into somebody is always the book that you think is done, because if you didn't, you wouldn't send it in. So you're kind of looking at thinking, well, I think this is done. I think this is the best I can make it. I think I've said everything I want to say. And then when someone comes back and says, you know what, and starts making suggestions, even when they come from the right place and even when they're kind of minor to major, it doesn't even really matter, you kind of feel like, wait a minute, and you get that little bit of defensiveness, which doesn't serve you well as a writer at all. So with me, I just think, okay, you have 24 hours to be a little bit defensive, which has nothing personal to do with Whitney at all. It could be anybody. And then you need to get to work. And she was such a tireless editor. I can't even tell you. And up until the last possible minute, and just, I mean, just... I'm so lucky, and not every... Okay, well, I can tell you not every writer gets that fortunate.
I'm going to interrupt you.
Go right ahead.
One of the things that I was told when I started working at Scribner by my editor-in-chief, she said, you know, look, the process of writing a book is a completely solitary act. It is a writer alone in a room typing away. And the process of reading a book is a completely solitary act. It is a reader reading alone in a room. And the editor's job is to connect those two individuals. And that is every step of the process. And so one of the things that you have to do is like imagine, okay, this. So here's solitary Whitney Otto writing, and then here's solitary imagined reader. what does this reader need to get out of what this person is doing? And so there's, you know, content and sort of questioning, and I don't really understand why this character would do this. Like, what, you're trying to anticipate what this reader might say, but then you're also trying to convince that reader to read the book. So you're begging people like Kathy Langer, who are incredibly influential, to read an early copy and, you know, champion the book. You're writing people to ask them to write reviews. You're telling people on the in the marketing group how we can position this book. So a lot of the work of an editor is going back and forth with the author about the content, but a lot of the work, the purpose of that is to sort of connect these two alone individuals.
And if I can jump in, I think where someone like me comes in is knowing the editor, knowing the house, trusting the editor when she'll send me something, and knowing I'm going to love it, but there's a lot of championing that goes on, and the industry is so much a matter of relationships, and I have editors who have stopped sending me their books because it's like, no, I really don't like what you're editing, and they, you know, other people do, and these books often sell really well, but you sort of get it's a dance, and finally you have to know when, you know, who your right partners are with what you like to read and sell. So my next question is for Whitney Frick, and you sort of started to talk about that. It was, how did you learn how to do this job? And
I'm not sure I even really know how to do this job today. I hope I'll know tomorrow. I mean, a lot of this is an apprenticeship industry, the way, so books would come in on submission when I was just starting, and I would read them, and then sort of present to my editor-in-chief or other editors what I thought. And then if they wanted, you know, you don't get to buy and acquire on your own at the beginning. So I spent a few years working with different editors in the imprint. And so I would sort of try to, like, I would do a round of edits, and then they would do a round of edits, and then I was the person photocopying the manuscript. So you'd sort of read, like, what did I say, and then what did they say? If they erased some of my comments, what were those? So that was part of it. And then I think another part of it is just, I've always been a reader, and I want to publish the type of books that I would want to read. And some of that is just sort of, and I still think I struggle with this, just trusting yourself. Like, yeah, this is a book I would want to read, so let's acquire it and let's publish it. And not every book that I want to read is a book my dad wants to read, or a book that, you know, someone who prefers other types of things want to read. But I have to believe that there are enough people who like the type of thing that I like. One of the editors I worked with, there was one manuscript I was working on. Actually, it was Joe Blair's by the Iowa Sea. And this writer wrote a series of essays that we had to put together to make a complete book. And it was a huge process, and I was on the floor of my office with all these essays numbered and, like, trying to figure out the order. And Colin Harrison, who's an editor at Scribner and also a writer in his own right, he came into my office, and it was kind of late at night, and he said, "Oh, you're really deep in the mud." And I was like, "Yeah, I really am. I don't know what I'm going to do." And he said, "Well, that's when the work happens, and that's when you're going to learn how to dig yourself out." So it's this sort of moment of, like, I have no idea what I'm doing, but I guess we're going to try to make a book here. And then you're lucky because writers know what they're doing. So a lot of what I do is sort of ask questions and say, like, "Well, I don't really get why this would happen." And that triggers something on your end.
Yeah.
Say, like, "Okay." After maybe 24 hours of, like, why doesn't she get that?
Is it not obvious?
Right. Then you sort of work on it, and then we just kind of go from there. Great. And, you know, I hope I'm better at this next year than I am this year, and that assumes the publishing industry is around next year. So.
Well, and also to say something, too, I mean, because I've been,
I've been doing this a while. And I think it's true. Words like trust and relationship and love are huge. I mean, everyone in publishing, I mean, you see a certain level of frustration, but the frustration comes out of a love for that industry and a love for books. And so the frustration isn't because they hate their jobs or they don't want to do this or, oh, this is, you know, terrible. It's more because they're fighting all the time and they're fighting for something that they love. And I think sometimes that gets really lost. You know, you'll talk to other writers or agents and, you know, everyone feels like a little frustrated or a little set aside. But that's not really, it's not, like I said, the frustration doesn't come out of something that they don't care for. It's almost like caring for it so much, you know. And that's what I have found over the years that has just been unchanging. And the level of work and expertise always astonishes me, because the payoff isn't always, you know, the equivalent of what they put into it, I think.
Yeah, that's true.
Whitney Otto, you've been doing this for a few years, and you have five novels and lots of other work that you've done.
Yeah, that one 20 years ago. I did that. I was 11, and it was really incredible.
But you've worked with lots of different editors over the years, I assume. And can you talk about what's worked with an editor and what hasn't worked with an editor? I mean, obviously, you and Whitney clicked really well. You don't need to name names. But was there a book or a process that was really different and maybe didn't work as well? Or just, you know, it's kind of an open...
Well,
what else have you experienced?
I mean, each editor has their own style. And as Whitney mentioned, it depends on sort of where you are on that chain, too, as to how much control you have or how much freedom you have. And my first editor was older than I, like Whitney is, and she was much closer to the top of that food chain and eventually gained her own imprint, and so she didn't have to ask anybody for anything, and that's a real luxury, a luxury that didn't last, by the way, a luxury that ended with Clinton, but she and as much as I like her, she wasn't actually, and I should say we're still friends today, but she wasn't the best editor for me. Whitney is a far better editor for me. My first editor, she had this great voice. It was like this, and she'd say, hi, you know. And so my husband, whenever she'd leave a message on the machine, my husband would be playing it over and over, because I'm like, hi, Whitney. It's me, you know. And one time, I sent her a completed manuscript, and I'd done like maybe three drafts. And she wrote me back a note, and all it said was, do it again. And I thought, do it again? Do what again? What do you want me to do? I mean, and that's an example of too little guidance, where you just think, I don't understand what's wrong for you. Because when you write, your novel begins to sort of groove in your head. So you start out with a lot of possibilities. As you're writing, those possibilities really narrow. And it's not like you're sitting there thinking, well, I could do A, B, C, or D. Well, I'll choose this, I'll choose that. And it's really hard, and that's why an editor is so invaluable, because it's a second set of eyes, it's a very, very interested reader, and a reader who's on board with what you want to do. And one of the great things about Whitney as an editor, too, is I think every step of the way, she was working with me to write the book I wanted to write, not necessarily the one that she wanted to read, if you understand what I mean. I mean, if there may have been changes that she would have made if she was thinking about, yeah, but I like this to happen, or I want that to happen, but she never did that. It was always working with me and helping me realize the book that I was trying to write. And like I said, with my first editor, it was a little too hands-off. And then I had another one for another book, too, who I thought was a good editor. And, you know, I don't have anything bad to say about anybody, I have to say. But Whitney has been my favorite, I mean, as far as editing goes, hands down, yeah.
Part of
when she walks out of the room, I'll tell you the truth. But yeah.
Know you're talking to my parents' friend.
Yeah. Her parents are sitting there.
I think also, I mean, there are things, honestly, I wish that we had changed in the book. And part of this is it's such a long, like, I had the book on submission in November of last year, and I needed to make sure that we had an absolute, absolute final, you know, press-ready draft by what? I think it was like February.
That's, I mean, you don't, yeah.
It's fast. You don't have that long. But then you sit there with this book that's like basically done for almost 9 months, 8 or 9 months. So I found myself going back recently and like reading things that I was like, oh, we should have talked about that, or oh, maybe this could have come out. But you're in the moment of it. And I mean, another thing that colleagues of mine have said is like, well, it's not your book. It's the author's book. And so at a certain point, you just have to say, like, have I tried to suggest or open up the questions that I can anticipate other people asking? Have we tried to address those? Ultimately, it is your decision. Yeah. And I think that's the best an editor can do, is to try to say, like, let's think about what might come up, but this is yours, and it has to be an expression of you. Otherwise, what happens is every book that Kathy looks at that has, you know, Whitney Frick editor attached to it or Nan Graham editor attached to it becomes the same, because it's just that editor's book, and that's not what we're trying to do. We have to have, you know, diversity of voices here.
Yeah, it's a matter of taste, but it's right. Not cookie cutter.
Exactly.
That would be awful. That would be so boring. Now I want to talk a little bit more about the business in general, and directing this first to Whitney Frick. And I'm not sure, when did you go to the Yale publishing course? Was that a couple of years ago?
It was summer 2011.
So fairly recently.
And the title of the course was Strategies for Managers in the Publishing World's Transition in a Digital Era, or something. I mean, it was like this jargony, basically, like, mayday, mayday, what are we
going to do? And that's good to know, because my question is about the changing nature of the industry, and I'm sure you were working and learning with the best minds in the world.
I mean, we're hoping.
I mean, it was an international group, so
right.
So you guys talked about that. So what are you seeing about?
Well, so I think one of the things that we're seeing is putting aside ebook versus what we call p-book, which is a print book. Because the media landscape has become so fractured and on demand in a way that it really hasn't been before. So, for example, if you used to get the paper New Yorker and then somebody threw it away or whatever, you couldn't go find that article that then somebody mentioned at a dinner party a month later. Whereas now you can like Google it up and find it. I have not missed a TV show that I've wanted to see in 2 or 3 years. Like, I can find any TV show online. And so, basically, reading is competing for leisure hours in a way it hasn't really had to before. And I notice this every time I'm on an airplane, because I feel like when I started in publishing and when I was in college, I was always really interested in what are people reading. I wrote my thesis at Northwestern on Oprah's book club's influence on female reading practices. So it's like something I've been interested in. Like, what do people read? Why are they reading it? So I always look, and especially on the subway, I'm looking to see what are people reading. And on the flight out here, nobody was reading. Everyone in my aisle, when I got to go to the bathroom, everybody's watching movies or TV shows on their iPads. So the huge challenge confronting publishers is, how do you make a case for reading in any format as worthy competition in a media landscape where attention spans are short? And there's a lot of ways you can try to do that. And that is complex, and I don't know the answers to that. But that's the big question. The question of ebook versus print book. Ebooks are not bad for publishers. People buy a lot of books for their reading devices, and we like that. We still make money off of ebooks sold. The problem is that, and one of the things that ebooks allows is, if you're at a dinner party and people start talking about this book, or you read the New York Times book review and you see this book mentioned, you can pull out your device and download it right there and then, without having to remember what the title is. But the problem is that Reading is, book buying and book selling is a word of mouth business in a way that many, many businesses are not. And publishers rely very, very heavily on influential and what we call big mouths. And Kathy, you're one of them. But these are people who, I mean, so Scribner is a very, very small publisher, and we publish 80 books a year. And we are a tiny little imprint within a big Simon & Schuster, which is one of six big publishing. I mean, there's so many books put out there every year. And to try to get everyone's attention is nearly impossible. And so what you find as publishers is you rely on people like Kathy and places like The Tattered Cover or Powell's in Portland, or even, I hate to say this, but the new and noteworthy emails that Amazon sends out, because people have to hear or see a title a number of times. So Kathy and her staff decide, what do we nominate for an IndieBound pick, best of the month? What books do we put at the front of our store? What books our staff recommends? So I think the big problem confronting publishers is how do we reward and engage with those people and encourage those people to continue to make recommendations that matter to readers and encourage readers to try new things without letting readers bring their devices to The Tattered Cover and use The Tattered Cover as a showroom. Or, you know, and so we're just competing for a lot of attention. And I think what's going to happen is there's going to be a lot of shrinking in the industry over the next probably 3 to 5 years. Just recently, Simon & Schuster was restructured, and one entire imprint was folded into another, and that was like 8 or 10 colleagues of mine who lost their jobs. There's going to be a merger between Penguin and Random House. So what we're going to see is we're going to start publishing fewer books, and each book is going to try to be much more focused. And it's not really looking good for avid readers because they want to have access to a lot of things. But I think it's probably necessary.
I don't think that's totally bad.
True.
I mean, it's hard for, I mean, it's going to be hard for authors and agents, but I think there's a lot of overpublishing that's happened.
I think that's true too.
That maybe we'll see a little more succinct and focused publishing, and so we'll have to see. I mean, it'll be what it'll be, and you know, the independents won't be disintermediated, as we like to say. And also, just to know, you can buy ebooks from The Tattered Cover, and so except on a Kindle. That's if you have a Kindle, Amazon owns you. I hate to say that, but we're actually now selling, as of last week, we're selling the Kobo e-readers. And you'll download the ebooks you download will be through Kobo. Kobo is an international company. And actually, it's the largest e-reader company in the world. So we're with a big company that's working with the independents, and we're really happy to be able to offer you an alternative. So just remember, you can buy ebooks from us, and it should be pretty easy to do. So we're really running out of time. We have time for maybe one or two quick questions. This has been so interesting. It's gone on a little longer than I thought.
Can I just say one thing, too? Uh-huh. One of the things that I really love about the way Scribner published this book is that there are these 8 photographs in it, and that's a whole other subject that we could go into. And I love the way that it looks. I love the way it's put together. I think it's something, I mean, if you like books as objects, I think it's a beautiful object. And it does give you something that you can't get on an e-reader, but I don't know if that's a last gasp or what. But it really is a beautiful little object, I have to say.
Well, and that, I think that's important that people who love books love the objet. They love the look and the feel and the typeface, and so books are not going away.
No,
they're not. P books are not going away. So okay, do we have any? There's one,
Anne.
So you mentioned the independents as the big mouths. How did it change Yeah, so they actually do. Barnes & Noble has a program called Discover New Writers, which is actually, it's a good, it's a great program. They choose, we submit first-time novelists or first-time memoirists, or occasionally it's like a writer whose first book really didn't sell, but this next book is sort of a departure. And they choose, I think it's, I can't remember how many per year. It's more than one per month, but it's less than like 50 per year. And those writers get front of store placement, and it means that the order from Barnes & Noble to the publisher is bigger. So that's one way they support us. Another way they do, placement at Barnes & Noble matters, what's on the front table. And so they do sort of, the way that works is there are booksellers at Barnes & Noble who will read our books and then decide if they want to take a strong stand on one of those titles, and they offer us the opportunity to pay them for placement at the front of the store. But it does, that really helps. It helps move titles. So that helps. And then Amazon, Amazon is the devil, but it's also, a huge engine for sales for us. And so Amazon now has, they used to call them the Significant Seven. I'm not sure how many it is right now. Sarah Nelson, who used to be the books editor at O Magazine, is now the editor-in-chief at Amazon. And I sent her this book three times with a personal note from me, and my boss sent her this book with a note from her, trying to get her to take on this book as something worthy of an e-blast to customers. So it was recently selected as one of the best of November in the fiction and literature category, and that helps. Then an email goes out to people that say, you might be interested in this. But what we find is that books that sell in the independent chains and that have this sort of growth of word of mouth in the independent chains, that is better for the life of the book, because then the chains kind of see what's working in the independents, and they say, so a good example of that is The Elegance of a Hedgehog. Isn't that? Yeah. That was this book that the independent booksellers, they made that book. It was a bestseller for a couple of years, and it was nothing. It was never in Barnes & Noble. Nobody knew about it until the independent booksellers started really selling it, and then Barnes & Noble started putting it in the front of the store, and because they didn't want to miss out. So,
that's not uncommon, which is great for us because the publishers pay attention.
Yeah.
So that's really, it's really a good thing.
And that was true of my first book. My first book became a bestseller strictly because of the independents, and the chains only picked up after that. And I didn't know at that time about independents or chains or anything. And that was before the large stores started sort of targeting some of the independents and building
that was
nearby.
Early '90s.
Yeah. And then some of the publishers began sort of having these conglomerations. But yeah, completely the independents. The career that I have, I'm absolutely indebted to the independents. They were very, very good to me, and I'm so grateful. Let's do this again. Oh, good. Okay. Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you all.
Thank you
very much for coming
tonight.
Whitney Otto will be signing.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.